Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. I think that Yoshihiro Tajiri was awesome. I think the Bullet Club is closer to the Baldies than the NWO. And I wish that, like Joel Gertner, Jerry Lawler would get beaten up and replaced by somebody better 5 minutes into every broadcast.
Hi, I'm G. John Chase. And I think that Spike Dudley throwing should be entered into the Olympics. My punchlines fall as flat as Franchine's chest in 96. And just like Scotty Anton, I too have the clap.
I'm Carl Jones, and I am more masculine than Jason, more feminine than Nicole Bass, and despite what some Hollywood casting agents would say, I believe that New Jack could have been the next Denzel.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke, and for this introduction, I honestly was going to put a lot of thought and effort into coming up with something really witty. Unfortunately, then, this iCloud thing went down, and to be perfectly honest, I've been a little preoccupied. Sorry.
This is the panel for the 13th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about whether ECW was all it was cracked up to be next. Hello everyone and welcome to the 13th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke along with G. John Chase.
I've got big balls.
Along with Carl Jones.
I'm Roller Jam's biggest fan.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
I didn't know we were doing taglines for this part of the introduction either. Then.
Well, it's one of those things that kind of takes on life of its own, you know.
Hi.
And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a very interesting show amongst the most polarizing feedback we've ever had for a subject on this podcast. I want to give a little bit of a mention to Luke Edwards, who's not on the panel today. He's in Uttoxeter in his new palatial estate, because the idea for this kind of a show, a myth-busting, legend-killing type of show, was originally his, and when it was brought up by Luke, Kieran, you had a specific suggestion that we're going to talk about today, which was ECW, and whether or not ECW was all it's cracked up to be. So is there any reason why this, off the air, just before we get going here, why this was the first thing that came to mind when this topic was raised?
Yeah, I just think ECW, for me, it's a massive double-edged sword in terms of absolutely brilliant booking and use of talent that Heyman had available to him, but at the same time, so many myths and maybe exaggerations on talent that have come out of ECW as well, and myths propagated by Heyman and followers and people who've, you know, liked the product, liked the show. There's no doubt about it. But yeah, I just think there's two sides to every story, I think, and I think there's a lot of examples in ECW of things which weren't crocked up what they used to be: talent, promos, angles. Yes, so it's an interesting avenue to explore.
Carl, I mean, just off the top, is, you know, your general thoughts on, I mean, it's very hard to say in a blanket way, but ECW, I mean, we're all coming into this with our kind of, you know, our own perspectives or stances on ECW. Kind of wondering where yours is right off the top.
Well, if we can cast our minds back to the last podcast, just for a second,
and the NWO.
The NWO discussion. And I think the general perception coming away from that was it was a bit of a mixed bag, wasn't it? Lots of positives, plenty of negatives, and you're sort of weighing up the two as to see which had the greater effect.
Yeah, but I will say, on that note though, I think that we came to a very mutual, and the feedback did too, kind of a mutual understanding about where the NWO stood, whereas I do think this will be different.
Yes, yeah, I think this will be different. I think this will be a bit more up and down, so to speak, peaks and troughs. But I thought the ECW sort of followed along similar lines from my perspective. There was a lot of good in there. There's some excellent wrestling. There were some great promos and angles, some that are probably overblown, as Kieran has said. But I think when you get maybe further down the sort of the timeline, so to speak, when you're getting into late 99, 2000, I think a lot of the problems that always existed in ECW were kind of brought home to roost in that time, and were quite glaring.
Yeah.
And I think we'll get to those, and especially some of the more romanticised parts of the product.
Okay, well, we were having a bit of a discussion before the show started earlier on today about how, in terms of perspective and people's opinion of ECW, ECW's kind of gotten off quite nicely from the WWE's revisionist history perspective. WCW always, it's the kind of the backhand when it comes to these DVDs and in general. But on WWE DVDs, they're a little bit kinder to ECW, and letting Joey Styles say that, you know, WWE's version of ECW sucked and ECW had this big impact on wrestling, sometimes at the expense of the WWF. You know, they brought ECW onto their show and kind of made them look like the cool promotion at times, whether it was in 1997 or when they did the first one-night stand. So just from your perspective, where do you think, how much do you think revisionism plays into this?
you know, history is written by the victors, and so that's perfectly the case with WWE. But like in terms of like the actual question, I'm kind of probably on a different basis to all of you guys. I mean,
I think you're going to be more universally positive than
yeah.
Than any of
I'm
us.
More universally positive for my own reasons, which I may or may not go into. For me, like, I'm not going to like deny that there was bad in ECW. So, certainly, there's bad. Same as there's bad in WCW.
Bad in any promotion.
Same in any promotion. ECW's no different. It's just with ECW, you judge it like the same way you do with WCW or WWF or TNA or anything. It's like, did the goods outweigh the negatives? And that's what we kind of used with other promotions. We used it with NWO on the last podcast. Was did the positive outweigh the negatives? And for me, watching it, yeah, it was always more positive than negative.
That's the kind of, there's one line you said there that I think is actually pretty interesting. It's something I want to dive into right before we get into the feedback, which is what you just said about how you know, compare, you know, looking at it the same way you look at WWF, WCW, and TNA and all these other companies, because the fan base of ECW, at times, whether it was through manipulation, through the TV or whatever, didn't necessarily give the same critical eye to their own product as they would to others. So there were certain acts that were not really up to par that they would give a free pass to because it was an ECW act and because the ECW presentation. There's certain ones that immediately come to mind when I say that, and I can see kind of half smiles around the table.
So that thing you're saying about you know, the ECW crowd not being as critical about... as critical to talent within ECW as they were with probably comparable talent outside of ECW. That for me is one of the as by what I mean by a double-edged sword, in that for me that is masterful manipulation of his target audience by Heyman. I think that's in one respect that's a feather in Heyman's cap. That's, you know, cultivating the environment for the, from the crowd, for the crowd that he was serving. I think, and if I'm wrong, probably Liam will be able to tell me better than this, whether to a degree that audience was already there before Heyman arrived as well, when they were even before their Eastern Championship Wrestling as well, I think. But am I right in thinking that was
elements of it were there before ECW pretty much
Eddie Gilbert before that maybe
Eddie
as well,
Gilbert so. Loved the blood and the and
was it IWA brought it over from
it was,
or
yeah Puerto it was Rico stolen from IWA. There's a lot of elements, yeah, that were taken, and the Tri-State
was it Wrestling Alliance?
Yeah, Tri-State Wrestling Alliance is what I was going to say. There were elements of this style in Philadelphia that were already existing that ECW pretty much just capitalized on, because with the fall of that and the rise of ECW, it just seemed like the logical thing. That audience, there was kind of there was a word that you mentioned before, zeitgeist, before the show started, which I think is going to be a very key word and a very key concept to this conversation in particular with regards to what got over and what didn't.
In terms of serving that crowd, Heyman, I mean, it was the elements of that were there prevalent in the Northeast, in that audience, that immediate audience, yeah, straight away. I think, and given the location of it as well, when he popularised it and expanded it, given the Northeast locale, that helped like propagate the myth of it as such outside the specific target audience at the time, kind of thing. So
I always compared it to like the computer game industry as well, as in with like computer games, you know, Mario and Zelda and a lot of games like that were very popular, but there was a certain group of people who were growing up now and wanted more adult contented games,
right?
And so, you know, they were still selling Mario and Zelda, but people wanted to see something different as they grow older. So I think like what Paul Heyman did with ECW is that he saw that there was a market for people who were children in the 70s and 80s who are now growing up and wanted something a little bit different. You know, WWF and WCW were still catering to the children of that era, but Heyman managed to see that little kind of like gap in the market of people who were too old to watch what WWF and WCW were producing.
It is very much a case of Heyman collecting the disenfranchised, if you like. I mean, in reference to Liam's earlier point about the fans and the lack of a critical eye, I think that's part of the manipulation by Heyman, and also the element of just sort of plain tribalism.
Yeah.
You know, if you think of it in, say, the family context, you watch something on the news, you hear about some junkie or some drug addict who does something, you know, nefarious, and that's an absolute, you know, disgrace of a human being. If it's in your family, what do you? It's the arm round, it's the support. It's that sort of thing.
Yeah. You see, we're going to get a social commentary.
Yeah, you know, you see where I'm going. So, in the wrestling context, it's the case of, well, we know those guys over there screw up all the time, and our guys aren't necessarily perfect, but there are guys.
Yeah. Mm.
There
were instances where the ECW fans would let people know if they did something wrong.
Yeah, I mean, are you I've got some strong opinions on the ECW fans, and I'm sure we'll get to those in a bit.
As a matter of fact, we're going to get to them right now, because we're going to go into the feedback, because this is going to be the meat of it. Bill Thompson from Pro Wrestling Only, why not start with a big negative? I'm not a big fan of ECW, and for the most part, I believe their importance and general quality has been overstated. Up until 95-96, I enjoyed ECW both as an in-ring product and as a fun time spent watching wrestling. Post-96, I found that the promotion became stale, predictable, and too in love with the hyperbolic and over-the-top just-for-the-sake-of-it nature. The funny thing is that I believe the quality of the in-ring work has stayed pretty consistent throughout the history of the promotion. It was the booking and writing of Paul Heyman that took a nosedive post-96, and by 1999, ECW was a product that I would contend was among the worst week-to-week wrestling I've had the displeasure of seeing. There's also the issue with the rabid ECW fans, who I believe have done more damage to wrestling than people care to admit. The smart crowd, with their chants of ECW and you fucked up, made the matches a chore to sit through. It was no longer about the wrestling or the angles, but about the fans and their desire to get themselves over. It didn't matter if two of the wrestlers were trying like hell to entertain them, should they have the audacity to slightly mess up a move or to grab a headlock, then the fans would start with their incessant and overbearing chants. To me, that is ECW's ultimate legacy, and it's a terrible legacy to have. ECW still has a great reputation in most circles, but it is an unearned and dishonest reputation that is fueled by myth and nostalgia. To me, ECW has become like WWF's Attitude Era, something people want to remember fondly, but if they truly go back and revisit that promotion or that era, they find out that 95% of what they thought was great was actually hogwash!
Well, I don't agree with that percentage at all. That last percentage is 95%. Nah, I'm
sorry. Well, see, you might be speaking kind of facetiously here, who knows.
Yeah.
But I will say that that's looking at one point as opposed to the larger points they tried to make, which is the Paul Heyman post-96 wasn't that great, and the fans in general. Since you touched on the fans, Carl, let's go there first.
Well, I do think they've been incredibly romanticised when you look back at it. I think everyone around this table seen the Forever Hardcore documentary?
Oh, yeah.
The non-WWE one? And I think they touch upon it there. Those fans could be absolutely bloody horrible. and they are sort of the precursor to what we see at some WWF shows
the
now.
We are awesome chants.
We are awesome, and you know, this is awesome. I hate that chant much.
That chant needs to...
But those ECW fans, yeah, they wanted to chant their own name. They wanted to get themselves, oh, look, it's Hat Guy, and the guy who looks like Jesus, and the old guy. And just for the record...
Sorry for listening.
Those are fans who regularly turned up at WWF pay-per-views back in the day. Chant, you sold out, and, oh, by the way, how much money did you pay Vince for that ticket?
Yeah.
But no, a lot of those fans were very much about themselves. It's hard to describe in a sense, but it's just they did want to be the show, and Heyman facilitated that in a large extent. You know, he did cater to them.
I think he kind of relied on it as part of the appeal massively.
It was part of the vibe for the show.
It was a selling point.
You know, it's the we're not coming to watch the show; we're part of the show. You know, the way he'd have the fans bring in, you know, for weapons night and that sort of thing. But
I think Paul Heyman obviously was going to choose. You know, if he had to make a choice over having a crowd that was very rowdy to like a crowd that was just dead silent, he was always going to pick those rowdy crowds.
Don't get me wrong; as you've touched on, it's absolutely part of the vibe.
Oh yeah,
but I.
And for the high points, it did work tremendously.
It did.
Let's go both sides of the coin. The fact that, you know, the crowd would sing every word to Enter Sandman helped make him something special.
Well, that was the only thing that made him special.
Yeah. Well, and there's a lot of things like that where the crowd did help certain guys. But like you said, the flip side could be quite a detriment.
Yeah, I think crowd's definitely one of those points when we talk about ECW that is actually a 50-50 for all the good they did. There was the bad, and whilst I do enjoy the ECW crowd and how they can get, you know, make a match, elevate a match through whatever they're chanting, I do agree about the, you fucked up chant. That was always constantly annoying. I never saw the point in that, considering they love the company and these guys so much. It's a bit kind of anti-productive, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it didn't really do the product. It's just... But I mean, they had a sense of... not really sure what the word is. I don't want to say entitlement or obligation, but they certainly had a certain standard that they weren't going to...
say entitlement.
Yeah, well, this is kind of a weird thing, because it goes both ways. They would overlook acts that weren't particularly all that good, like the Pitbulls, like the Public Enemy, like the Sandman, like the Gangsters. Certain, and I'm not saying that these guys had absolutely nothing to get put to the table. I'm just saying that they would overlook, in some cases, guys that they chose and liked and decided to like. But at the same time, they would be picky. It's kind of a weird duality.
What do you think is because, like, as you said, with those kind of people that you named, not obviously being very good in the ring, when it comes to like people who were good, and they fucked up? You think it's just because, you know, they were expecting more from them? In their eyes, they saw these chosen ones as perfect.
I think that's maybe a bit too cerebral.
Yeah.
Care to elaborate on that point, Mr. Cerebro?
I don't think they put that much thought into it when they sat there and thought it's because we expect so much more from this guy. We're gonna chant "you fuck up" when he makes a mistake. I think they're just gonna sit there and go, "Oh, there's the mistake. Let's go for it."
Yeah,
it's just part of their show. I think it was part of that.
It's the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally. I mean, say the negative is the absolute positive of that crowd is that they may. Because they were so hot a lot of the time, in their own right, having a good time, whatever the case may be, it still makes talent look like it's more over than maybe in monetary terms it really is. It's still, I kind of liken that crowd, especially in the early days, to the TNA crowd. Yeah, this is going to piss people off.
You know what? It's actually a very interesting point, because I was actually going to say this, and we didn't talk about this point previously, but the kind of similarities between that NXT... Yeah, the current NXT, TNA, and ECW Crown. Now, ECW Crown was different in the sense that they actually did pay to get in.
It's one thing, yeah.
But that whole thing of the insular nature, which is what you're going to touch on now, is part of why some of these guys became cult characters.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you said it yourself. I mean, that, as I said on the, I think as I said on the TNA butchery, that was. In that, it's a false crowd. It's false, you know, guys getting over in the social club is different to guys getting over, you know, to the mass audience. I think people are paying their ticket money. As you say, yeah, that ECW, they had to pay for tickets. But the point being is in that kind of insular environment, which it helps guys look more over to the outside world than maybe they actually really are to the wrestling audience en masse, kind of thing. And absolutely, that is a factor of it, and I think on all elements. But again, the other side of that is you give massive credit to Heyman for doing a great job booking a wrestling post. I mean, the one thing I was going to say when you said about the smoke and mirrors, but that's the job of a booker, is to use what you've got at your disposal to create a fresh, interesting product. And you, last 3 weeks of WWE TV are perfect examples of this. Just guys, this is two-dimensional, shallow guys. Nothing, no interest, no interesting storylines.
They've got
no
their framework, and they're just going to put these plastic
guys
action figures in the roles they've determined.
We'll get hope that, oh wow, Wyatt's a different character. We're going to see something different out of him booking wise.
Nope,
and he's just using exactly the
not
same
a single
way.
Different idea for him than anybody else on the roster.
Yeah, it's, and
which, given that character, seems absurd.
So you give massive credit to Heyman for actually making stuff with what he had. But I think if what we're saying is the flip side of that is a lot of that wasn't what it was presented as, then maybe, absolutely. I totally agree with that. I mean,
exactly. And so every now and again, some people fall through the cracks, you know, like you have to like try everything to see what works. But when it comes to like Paul Heyman as a booker, as like try and think, like, how do you think Eric Bischoff or Vince Russo or even Vince McMahon himself would have done with that roster at that time? Well, how well do you think they would have done with them?
Well, would
they have done as good a job or better than Paul Heyman?
It's completely hypothetical.
I know it's hypothetical, I generally think, I don't think they could do.
Yeah,
that.
But at the same time, we can never tell because they've never been put in that situation.
You know, we say, well, Vince got a lot more money out of Steve Austin than Heyman did, so it's easy to argue
both
ways.
It lasted for a lot longer.
It is a hypothetical, but the one thing I would say to that point is, Tommy Dreamer would have meant nothing outside of ECW. I think we can be quite confident with that.
He didn't.
And do we really think someone like Taz, do you think they'd have had the thought to use him as a killer? To try and build him as some sort of killer? I think we can say with a certain, with a degree of certainty that Vince certainly wouldn't have gone down that road in the land of the giants. And we only have to look at what happened to Taz.
We've got the proof.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, I'm a big Taz fan from the ECW period. But I will actually concede that point. You're absolutely right. I think Paul Heyman was able to see something in Taz that he could use. Vince McMahon, as you said, in the land of the giants, Taz would have got so lost.
He would have just seen either a guy that he thought was a genuine midget or someone who was walking around on his knees all day.
Well, this is the thing. The Tasmaniac did get a tryout and they didn't sign him. So that tells you everything you need to know right there.
And also, when they did eventually sign him properly in 2000, it quickly
after Heyman showed him what to do, they just decided, nah.
After Heyman showed him what to do, after the reaction he got at the Royal Rumble 2000, and just...
Well, it's funny, because we'll get into this. Actually, you know what? We'll take a we had a bit of a detour there. Heyman's booking in general post-96. Now, obviously, before 1996, you know, well, not necessarily before 1996. I would include summer 1996 at least in terms of Heyman's prime period of what he did, because the television show was great. And I, part of this discussion came about, you know, the reason we're doing this now is the Paul Heyman DVD was just released, and there's some great footage on that DVD showing him producing guys and coaching guys and trying to bring out the best body language and the best promo skills out of them. It's very, very interesting to watch. The thing I love about the ECW TV show is they'll have guys who basically are doing promos that are just one-liners, and they'll just cut it off right there, and yeah, they'll splice them into the Pulp Fiction montages or whatever it is. They would show clips of matches that weren't that good. They wouldn't necessarily show the whole match. They would show a lot of, you know, in-ring angles that got over well, good matches here and there, a lot of very kind of special particular booking during that time frame. And we're seeing this a lot now. There obviously is a framework that the WWF has that is not going to be broken for anyone, but
rigid to say the least
will only be broken for a few exceptions. And WCW was more of a let's throw the Monopoly board up in the air and hope the hotels land on Mayfair approach.
Yeah.
ECW having this thing, do you believe that it kind of peaked, you know, it peaked in 96 and everything after that was bad, like Bill says? Or
no, I think he's overstating it to some degree there. I think Heyman's booking was fine going into 97. I still think it was pretty strong leading up to Barely Legal as the first pay-per-view, because you've still got the hot Raven Dreamer feud, throwing the salmon in there, Funk as the old veteran. I still think it was perfectly fine. I think what you see as time goes on is quite a focus to mirrors the WWF now, or the WWF at its peak, rather. You have a situation where it's sort of a top-heavy focus. I think Heyman's focus was very much there, because he's still, you know, he's through 97, 98, you've still got Taz as the killer being built up to Douglas and the world title. But I think it was a case of his eyes were on one or two key individuals, Van Damme being another, and the rest of the card was sort of just left to, let's pair off these guys. I mean, I love the Tajiri and Super Crazy matches, but we had those on a hell of a lot of pay-per-views and a hell of a lot of video releases.
They went to the well on quite a few of these combinations.
Quite a few matches, yeah. I think that gives an example of how he would just let everything underneath the top of the card just sort of float along steadily.
I think I'm probably going to be the one that sticks out here, because whilst I do like all the 95, 96, so on, I actually enjoyed, I still liked ECW 98, 99. I'll concede sometime in 2000 it started getting noticeably weaker due to what I've already stated in previous podcasts about you know, certain members of talent leaving in 2000, which greatly dented ECW in its final year. But for me, I still heavily enjoyed 98-99. If not, probably for me, they're probably my two favourite years.
Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it wasn't enjoyable as time
went
on.
Yeah, neither am I.
We're not saying that at all. But I think with regards to 2000 that you mentioned there, I don't care how creative a genius you are.
Yeah.
When your talent is going elsewhere and you're left with the likes of Danny Doring and Roadkill, yeah. There's only so much you can do. You can be as creative a genius as you want. If the tools aren't there, you know, you're hitting that glass ceiling.
I mean, if you actually, like, as Liam referenced, if you actually watch the Paul Heyman DVD, which you should buy and watch, he does actually reference that last year of ECW, and that, like, Paul Heyman during the actual shows themselves
wasn't there.
He was just too busy trying to keep the company afloat or whatever.
Oh, so, he was doing Roller Jam,
yeah. So he wasn't as hands-on as he used to be.
I just wonder as well, an element in this is, was the product underexposed in 94 to 96? And it's a lot easier to forget about the undercard dross, because I'm sure there was comparable to Doring and Roadkill on the undercard.
There certainly was.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the myths of ECW, is that who was watching it during its prime years? I don't know. I wasn't. Retrospectively, yeah, but live and absorbing it at the time, I wasn't. 94, 96.
No, I think you're right. I think a lot of people, if there's any basketball fans out there, if I use the Wilt Chamberlain example here.
Wilt the Stilt.
The man who makes 100, scores 100 points in one night for the Philadelphia Warriors, I think it was at the time. Now, that was an arena that held about 5,000 to 6,000. You must have got a good, you know, 40,000 to 50,000 people claiming they were there. And I think I think there's a lot of that with ECW. A lot of us have watched ECW, and we've watched the old stuff, 94, 95, 96. I think a lot of people, if they're really honest, didn't see that at the time. They went off hearsay, they went off word of mouth, and they've gone back retrospectively and watched.
Yeah, and obviously, and there are a lot of elements that do look good with hindsight from that period of time. There was a lot of quality. Now, we've talked a little bit of negative here. That's time for a bit more positive. Sean Liska from Pro Wrestling Only. I'm not going to try to win you guys over on the quality of ECW, but you've got to remember the context of the time to see why ECW did appeal to so many people. The territories had all been put out of business. WCW, who was the last bastion of hope for the American smart fan, and then Bischoff came in and totally sold out the promotion's soul. Hogan retired our hero Ric Flair after treating him like a whipping boy for several months, and Starrcade was headlined by Hogan and his buddy Brutus. The WWF had always been the enemy, but it had become worse and more irrelevant than ever, bottoming out with a catastrophic King of the Ring 1995 and a SummerSlam headline by Diesel and Mabel. As pessimistic as people feel about today's wrestling scene, it was much, much worse then, because business was in the toilet and their views of talent was quite a bit more out of date than now. Sean Liska continues after that, saying, "Then this company comes along and treats Terry Funk with reverence. Sabu is blowing people's minds. They're bringing in guys like Benoit and Malenko that the big two wouldn't touch because they were so out of touch. They're using current music and producing videos that look like the stuff from MTV. You've got great angles, like the Sandman pretending to be blind. Heyman and Douglas are preaching to the choir about everything that's wrong with American wrestling. The Raven character fit the time perfectly. They're ahead of the curve in tapping into the UFC with Taz. The Pulp Fiction montages that were so much more hip than anything else we were getting anywhere else. They're bringing in the AAA guys, and Joey Styles is saying everything we think about Eric Bischoff. You can look back at parts of the ECW or Attitude Era and say, this sucked. Why do people look back on this fondly? How was this successful? But there was a reason it connected with people. It's not that easy to fool people into becoming passionate about pro wrestling." Interesting points there. Obviously, you know, the landscape at the time is crucial to why ECW was popular. What do you think about that last line? It's not easy to fool people into becoming passionate about pro wrestling. Is that something I actually disagree with?
Yeah, I totally disagree with that.
I think that wrestling fans, even though they are cynical in nature, pessimistic in nature, when something that looks like it could be good comes along, wrestling fans, the hardcores especially, the ECW kind of crowd, are the first people to give something a chance because they want it to be good.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. It's the, again, off topic, but yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, for me, it's even today, you watch WWE TV and you see some one angle one week and you still get the eternal hope that they're going to do something good with it.
Yeah, exactly.
On the whole, we are a forgiving bunch as wrestling fans, with the nature of being a wrestling fan, I think. So I think I disagree with that. I think it's just tapping into that collective conscience of your particular audience that in that environment, in that moment in time, to deliver what people want. So.
Yeah, I think to echo Kieran's remarks to an extent, I think it's easy to fool the likes of us into being passionate about wrestling because we are passionate as a starting point.
Yeah.
Whether that's being ridiculously, you know, over the top positive about something, or being incredibly cynical, as we have been with Raw over the last several weeks, which you alluded to before, we care already.
Yeah.
So
our interest is at 90 to begin with.
Our interest is already there. So it's just like getting that blasting cap at the end of the day for people like us.
This is a good one here from King Pitcast from the UK Fan Forum. This will probably tap into a lot of commonalities around this table. I started reading Power Slam in 1996 and loved ECW from the descriptions and the photos. Then ECW started on Bravo a couple of years after that. And what a load of shit it was. You finally get to see it in motion. I don't think I've ever been so disappointed by anything in wrestling as I was by seeing an ECW broadcast for the first time. I'll take One Night Stand, the Rise and Fall documentary, and loads of WWE's ECW over any actual ECW shows. Not sure about the last one.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that last sentence.
No reason to be silly.
Although, actually, that does go to that point somewhat, because obviously, as PowerSlam readers, the photos and the descriptions about, you know, this crazy stuff that was going on that seemed so nuts when all we were getting were WWF pay-per-views on a delay of fucking Henry Godwin v. Sid on a pay-per-view in 1995.
We're live there, pal.
I will say that the first time when we got Sky, and remember the German channel DSF?
Yeah.
Do you remember we used to watch, there's like a wrestling show on Saturday nights on DSF, and the first time I ever saw ECW in 96, they played a Raven Shane Douglas match, and after all that I'd heard about ECW, I remember watching that match thinking I was going to see death, destruction, something I've never seen before, and it was a very regular paint-by-numbers match.
Pro wrestling.
it's just a pro wrestling show.
Well, with things like Power Slam, which is a publication that I always loathed, just for the record. When you're going off just sort of a bit of a description and one or two stills, it's part of that mystique, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's that hype. And nothing will ever quite, even if things generally deliver, nothing ever quite meets your expectations 100%, if you're honest, do they? Especially not with not with fans with the mindset of ECW, you know, or fans such as us, because we're always looking for that perfection, and it's never going to quite be there.
Perhaps my new favourite name, username of anybody that's written in, Colin Bollocks from UK Web Forum. I never liked the ECW product. I always thought that was due to the humour and embarrassment of my dear old gran and granddad staying up with me to watch the wrestling, only to turn over and see Dormarie flash her tits and make some shit innuendo about sucking a willy. However, revisiting some shows on the network, it wasn't only the memory of my loving gran and granddad thinking their grandchild was a depraved soul. The production isn't up to it, which always puts me off wrestling shows, and it seems like every match someone blows a spot or two, but they try and repeat the same spot a moment later. It's not for me or my grandparents.
They should have used that as a tagline for the company. ECW, it's not for your grandparents.
Just a detour from feedback here. This podcast is going to go in peaks and valleys. There's going to be periods of positivity, there's going to be periods of negativity, and I think this is the perfect time, stemming from a couple of negative bits of feedback about ECW, to talk about Tommy Dreamer. Kieran, you have some strong thoughts about Tom Dreamer.
That was a beautiful segue there, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, when you get this off your chest at last, this has been building up for years.
I just don't think I could get it all off my... It's like... Oh, Tommy Dreamer. He's useless in the ring, annoying on the mic, talentless buffoon. I can't articulate my angst towards this fat fuck enough. And to have this guy synonymous with your company, I liked it.
He's got his head in his hands.
I'm struggling here because in that environment that had been created by Heyman, he was their staple. Home, you know, boy made good kind of thing. So I get to that audience why they had an affinity towards him.
They'd seen him grow up before their eyes.
Yeah,
in that sense.
I guess. And he was one of theirs in that, you know, bit of pride. But the guy is fucking useless.
No, okay, this is the thing. to break down, as opposed to just bold statements, let's break it down. I don't think. Clearly he would make a lot of physical sacrifices for the company. Some of the bumps that he took from the Brian Lee chokeslam through all the tables and all that stuff, a lot of physical sacrifices he would make. I think he could sell. I do think that he was good at getting sympathy in the ring.
Yeah, I think that I don't even dislike Tommy Dreamer that much. I do agree to Kieran's point that he's criminally overrated by the ECW fans, but he could sell. And I think one of the reasons the fans there connected with him was because he was able to convey just how much he really did care about the company, whether it was, you know, through those some of them rather sickening bumps and some of the things he would do to himself.
Yeah.
Especially all the things involved with the Raven feud. I think they saw that he cared about the company as much as they
the
did. So that's where the affinity was. It's almost as if it's a case of, well, I could have been that guy. I think we can all, you know, you can look at plenty of people and say they could have been a Tommy Dreamer.
Yeah. And the thing that really irks me, I've mentioned that what I think is a plus there with the selling, that the thing of what you just said there, you could tell, you know, he got over because he was trying so much. I think it's the fact that he seems like he's trying so much that irks me with his promos.
He tries so hard!
Because on his promos, he's trying so hard to convey whether he's trying to be a badass or he's trying to be angry. Mm. And you could just, it's that thing where when he stops, and sometimes he would just look in the camera and you can just see it in his eyes. Like, even though he's giving you that smouldering, sexy, I'm going to kick your ass look that he's trying to give, there's just something really false about his delivery. And I think it seems like this guy's trying and trying and trying. He's performing to try and impress us. That really kind of, I think at first, the ECW, and obviously at first, the ECW fans didn't take to it for the same reason we don't.
I'm not even trying to pretend that I'm making an articulate, intelligent point when it comes to Tommy Dreamer.
You think it's just irrational?
I have an irrational. It's not irrational. He annoys me for a reason.
You just can't put it into words.
It is irrational. I don't know. I just don't like Tommy.
So were you not a fan of the promo where he has the candle wax burn onto his hand? No? Dripping down?
I wish New Jack had choked him with his braces back in the day and it would just solved us all a lot.
What about when he double kissed Beulah and what's her name?
Kimona Wanalea?
Yeah. Well, and says, I'll have both, I'm hardcore.
Yeah, of course.
K-Hawk 20 from Pro Wrestling Only. I liked it at the time, still do, in smaller doses. I know a few people that have drifted away from watching wrestling on TV over the years that tuned into ECW when it finally came on TV here and were blown away with what they were seeing and got dragged back into weekly viewing. The thing for them that it was such a different product than we'd been watching when they faded away from it. The initial shock of what they were seeing was enough to capture their imagination and their interest again. Don't discount the rabid, chanting, nutty crowd and the effect they had on new viewers either. Paolo Butchi from UK Fan Forum. ECW was what it was cracked up to be when no one was watching it, but it peaked and steadily declined from 1995, to your point, Kieran. They didn't get pay-per-view clearance until 97, and 1998 ECW is one of the worst years of any promotion I've ever seen other than Heatwave. The Douglas vs. Snow match from WrestlePalooza is a fucking abomination, and them doing all the shit like it was a classic just made even worse, and made me angry because it was so fucking bad. In fact, from about 1997, the mid-card with people like the FBI were normally more interesting and better than the same old shit on top. Shane Douglas from his return in 96 was the shit. Any edge he had before he went to New York was just replaced with swearing a lot, going ha ha ha! About three times every bloody sentence, and a fucking massive gut. Shane Douglas thoughts around the table.
I'll hold on the burial first. Shane Douglas, yeah, and WrestlePalooza, yeah. I think that was when he was wrestling Al Snow, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was a feud. Whilst in terms of like the promotional videos that they were playing up for, it looked like it was going to be good because they developed the whole thing with Head with Al Snow and so on. And then when the match actually came about, it was fucking awful. Al Snow's not a main eventer. He's not on the cut side of Shane Douglas though. Whilst I don't think he was a good worker, and probably obviously not necessarily the focus of a company, I did think that he was good on the mic. I think he was good at portraying an asshole heel, yeah, which at that time ECW needed. They needed that focal heel.
Yeah, there were merits to Douglas in what he did. I don't think any of us around the table are massive, fans of the French fries.
Nah, I could easily have you wiping from the wrestling history, and I wouldn't probably know.
I think he won best on interviews in the Observer in 1994.
When was, speaking of the Observer, what was the Sabu Bret Hart thing?
There was a controversial quote where Dave Meltzer said that he thought, this was at the time, that the best worker in 1994 anywhere in the world was not Bret Hart, it was Sabu. Again, going back to the great illusionary skills of Paul Heyman, but also, not to discredit Sabu, a lot of what he was doing seemed breakthrough and very, very fresh. Different and fresh at that time.
If I may come in at this point.
Shane Douglas and Sabu were the topics at hand.
Yes. Well, bearing in mind what Kieran said earlier about Tommy Dreamer is an irrational hatred, I feel somewhat the same about Shane Douglas, the Target World Champion. Let's be clear on this. Shane Douglas, on his day in 94, was capable of some good promos. Once you get through to his world title run, it is just curse words. It is just swearing. There's not a lot of meat on the bones to his promos.
No, not at all.
He was never that good a wrestler. I know he gets agitated by the idea of Flair holding him back. He was never that good. Someone show me the series of classic Shane Douglas matches. You won't find them. You know why you won't find them? Because they don't exist.
I do love the Steamboat Douglas Hollywood Blonde series. That's the best I can do.
But what's the denominators in there? You've got Steve Austin, Brian Pillman, and Ricky fucking Steamboat.
Are you saying that if you were the fourth man in the ring,
Steamboat,
if you were the fourth man in the ring, Carl, would the match have been the same? Is what you're saying right here on this podcast?
If I was the fourth man in the ring, the match may have even been better.
I think some of the points you made are very valid.
Let me just get the franchise. The franchise. Who christened him the franchise? If
himself.
Memory serves me correctly, he christened himself the franchise.
Yeah. Well, irrational hatred, Kieran. You have your turn.
Who are you to judge me?
We all get our turns, Kieran.
God damn it. You're not allowed to christen yourself the franchise. You never became the franchise of anything. If he was lucky, he was Target's employee of the month.
Yeah. The whole his anti-WCW thing and like Ric Flair did get very tedious from the obvious fact as the obvious points you made was that he was obviously never that good to begin with. Ric Flair was obviously better than him. But the two other points that you kind of mentioned, which you didn't like as promos, which I'll slightly disagree with, is the title belt getting thrown down. Was a very key moment for Shane Douglas, and I don't think the company had anyone else that could have pulled off that moment and that speech that Shane Douglas did. And also, towards the end, before he lost the title to Taz at Guilty as Charged 99, and he had the arm injury, considering obviously he wasn't able to work for a lot of that time period, I thought he did a very good job of keeping interest in that match. Obviously the crowd just wanted Taz to kill him, which he subsequently did. But I thought Shane Douglas did a good job of putting that match over whilst not being able to compete in the ring.
I think the fact that he was... Because when you look at Shane Douglas' 997, it wasn't a good year. If anybody, the biggest choke artist at Barely Legal was Shane Douglas in the
oh God,
excruciatingly
yeah.
long match Jesus. That I think might still be going on with Pitbull number 2. The stuff for the rest of the year, he was so injury prone. He was so... Yeah. I didn't think that he was the guy that you should have built the company around. No. Of course, they did.
I mean, the match where he wins the title back, when he wins the title from Bigelow at...
November to Remember
wasn't particularly good either. Well, it had that vibe of it being in Pittsburgh and that, at the Golden Dome, was it?
Yeah.
So you had that hometown crowd vibe. But I just think Shane Douglas was criminally overrated. He was never as good as he believed. And I think most people's opinions really bear out how, you know, where he really is in the annals of wrestling. I think you get a more honest appraisal from general peers and general fans than you ever would from Shane Douglas.
I admire your hatred for Shane Douglas, but he doesn't offend me as much as most other people who did end up in that company.
This is a question I'm asking to the other three, you other guys here. Did their kind of expansion, was that in keeping with the kind of the growth of the wrestling industry in the late 90s?
I think it absolutely was.
So, yeah, that's my question really.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I think that the fact was that wrestling was ballooning. There was more people who would be attracted to the ECW thing, obviously brought him because it was the spirit of the time. There's a more rowdy bunch watching wrestling anyway. Here's ECW. If they stumbled upon it, then this is a past street as well. Let's go and watch ECW. Mm. I think it was absolutely part of it. I don't think that any one star really drew that many people in ECW history.
No, not really. And to just backtrack a little bit, because I did sort of not blindside the panel, but try and dominate it there with my Douglas rant. But Sabu was someone who was mentioned there, and I think if there was ever an individual on the roster who, through Heyman's smoke and mirrors, they were able to make them seem greater than they ever were, I think that was Sabu. And I don't want to cast complete dispersions on Sabu. He was incredibly innovative. Some of the stuff he did is fantastic to see. You know, the triple jump moonsault, Arabian facebust, all those sort of spots. They're really cool things to see. And the look really works with the scarred body and all that sort of thing. But he, to me, is one of their top stars who is really overrated. And the reason I say that is an earlier email I mentioned about constant botch spots and let's go back to it. And that was one of the things that always grated on me when it came to Sabu. He could make a hell of a lot of errors during a match. If the night wasn't going to plan, he could make a hell of a lot of errors, and rather than sort of try and just work around that, he would go back to the spot and it would look so contrived, and it never really sat well with me because of that.
I think that's absolutely a fair point, to be honest. I think how I always saw like Sabu, and when you're talking about like the way he did spots and so on, there were times where he spent far too much time setting up spots and not actually, you know, concentrating on his opponent, which just looked weird from a psychology point of view. For me with Sabu, I always thought that Sabu was a great music video wrestler. He was better at being in those montages, like the beginning when they're playing, you know, the ECW music and they're showing like all the top moves and stuff. Sabu was great in that moment, and as you said with the image of the scars, he was a great visual and a great music video wrestler, but the actual matches themselves didn't have any psychology.
Wouldn't you say that is synonymous with the whole company, really?
With a few of them.
I think the whole, just to make the point, I think it's a company that was, given the nature of the TV as well, 1 week's... Can you imagine one hour a week with that talent? Imagine doing like a live 2 hour show. God damn it, they would expose her for a month. But no, on a 1 hour a weekly highlight form TV show,
Joey Styles the narrator, constantly going to the adverts for the shows that are coming up, and then splicing in certain little bits and pieces of the matches.
Yeah, I just think it was inherent with the way that company was. It was double-edged sword. Again, that's what they had to work with, but at the same time, it was almost an opportunity to allow them to hide talent, that not overexpose them to the mass audience until... When were they going to see them? After they bought a DVD or something? It's, you know.
Yeah. I think they used, obviously, that kind of music video kind of... mentality, that MTV mentality, a lot to obviously put their product over. But I also think that was also a sign of the time for television in general, is that
short attention span
was starting to happen in the general public, and if you're going to catch someone as someone's flicking through all the channels, you had to do something like ECW was doing and get their attention straight away. That started to bleed over a little bit into the Attitude Era as well, in the WWF.
Three minute matches,
just like let's get someone in, get them out again, get someone else in, and just see we can try and get someone to stay on the channel long enough. I think they use the music video kind of mentality to help push their product and hide the negatives, but I also think it was a product of the current television climate as well.
Alrighty, so we've had a bit of negative in a row. It's time to get to a little bit of positive feedback here. Sidebottom from Pro Wrestling Only. ECW peaked in 1995 in terms of in-ring with Malenko, Guerrero, Benoit, character development with Raven, Sandman, Taz and Sabu, and storylines such as Dream and Raven and Foley vs. ECW. 1995 was when they were consistent. After that time, they were a mixed bag. For every consistently great show from top to bottom you had, like Anarchy Rules 99, Guilty as Charged 2000, and Heatwave 98, you had an equally dud card from top to bottom, such as WrestlePalooza 98. No one likes that show, from the sounds of this. Which, for my money, was the worst card of 1998. But to summarise, I loved ECW when ECW were presenting a hot product. Were they everything they were cracked up to be? Depends on who is hyping them up and to what extent. I'd argue their influence, taken from Onita, who in turn took elements from Memphis Wrestling, was obviously very important to Western wrestling, so the influence of ECW and a lot of the good, the positives, obviously bled over into what would end up being successful. The influx of guys like Rey Mysterio, Juventud Guerrero, Psicosis, obviously was very, very important for getting to WCW. The Benoit Malenko Guerrero exposure helped a lot. The Cactus promos, the Austin promos, a lot of the obvious positives here influenced the direction of American wrestling.
Yeah, with regards to the in-ring talent section of that, ECW was an excellent conduit for talent who had made their name in Japan or made their name in Mexico, who wouldn't have had the platform in North America, you know, wouldn't have had that exposure. And that was one of Heyman's and ECW sort of thinking, you know, ahead of the curve, so to speak. You know, you wouldn't get a Rey Mysterio, you wouldn't get a Psicosis, you wouldn't get a Malenko and Benoit, you wouldn't get them in WWF because of the size.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have got them in WCW at the time because it was Hogan and his friends running amok. So ECW was an excellent conduit in the mid-90s to get a lot of talent, that foot in the door. You know, and maybe sort of close to home in that respect, the likes of Jericho and Storm as well, just to mention a couple more names.
And again, that this litany of great talent that you kind of want to see, it kind of helps that... It's almost like the kind of the hipster band thing of I liked them before they were popular with a lot of, you know, yeah. I like these guys, so I've seen them from tapes in Japan and Mexico, and now we're getting to see them here in our company from the ECW fans' perspective before we're seeing them anywhere else, which is kind of, you know, it helped the fans feel like they were on the cusp. The guys themselves are obviously phenomenal.
I think, yeah, again, I just agree that, I mean, there's no doubt ECW gave opportunities to talent which wouldn't have made it onto a mainstream stage with probably that ECW. That's probably hard to say, because I think if there wasn't an ECW when in the late 90s, when you got the war going on and there's a massive scramble for talent, would they have been brought in from Mexico or Europe or Japan? Would that have happened anyway? We can't say. I'm inclined to think maybe eventually they would have, because if you're looking for talent, if you're that desperate for talent. Heyman was working with, again, he had a finite stable. He had to use what was available. So that's, you know, it kind of that plays into the favour of bringing this new talent in. Again, this thing that's just going around in my head is about did they rely upon stars to drive the business? It's always going to be the case, but if the brand itself was kind of the priority, I think it offered them the opportunity to play with talent, which there's a prejudice in the big boys maybe they wouldn't do, because how would they affect business? And I think that's an element maybe that's it's only a positive to ECW, but I think it's one of the factors that played in anyway. So.
Well, obviously two names that you mentioned there, and it's usually mentioned when you're talking about top guys, being obviously Mick Foley and Austin, did have very actually quite brief times in ECW, and I think whilst in the long run, I don't actually think they did anything really to help ECW. I think it was more ECW helped them more than the opposite way around, because those, when you look at those Foley promos, those anti-hardcore promos, or Austin when he was like, you know, starting to tweak that kind of Stone Cold-esque character, I don't think you ever would have saw those type of promos in WCW or WWF at that time.
Yeah, I'd actually agree. I disagree with that. I think they were massively important to ECW because it was the stigma and the aura of ECW is the place where we'll discover the talent and we'll allow talent to be themselves and bring it out. It's also all part of that aura of you know, using guys right kind of thing, and the Heyman Talent Factory.
Because of what we mentioned earlier on with the branding as well, I do think it's an important kind of point to note there. We can't really grade ECW the same way you would look at whether a pay-per-view gets over or, you know, a certain angle gets over in terms of monetary results. So if it's all artistic and the people and the fans who are, you know, hopefully loyal to ECW, their belief on the product is completely based on the artistic element. So going to your point, that's where those promos are absolutely key, because without these great elements of guys coming in, delivering the best of their evidence and making ECW seem like the place where everybody can actually be their best. Brian Pillman, the Loose Cannon, did his best stuff in ECW.
The emancipator of talent. Yeah. That's what ECW was.
I mean, obviously all these guys did come in, sorry Carl. Obviously these guys all did come in and did great work that obviously showcased what ECW was able to do with these guys. It's just for me, they were all there for such a short period of time. In the long run, I don't think it really did that much.
But
I think
when you look at it from that perspective, who that was there long term really meant anymore, because no one really drew the massive buy rate from that perspective either. So
yeah,
it kind of goes both ways.
Yeah, it's kind of tricky because as you said, it was always a company on the rise, and it never got to any sort of, it never plateaued at a high. It never did. So I don't know. I'm going to throw it out there. I think probably the closest person they ever got that could have been like a big draw for them was probably Taz.
Van Damme
as well.
Van Damme gotten...
Didn't get injured.
Had he not got injured and had he been elevated and had Mike Awesome not fucked off, I think that was the ultimate plan, wasn't it? Van Damme gets the belt. Van Damme actually had the ability and the charisma and the connectability to the crowd to draw money.
Yeah, that...
With regards to talent... not necessarily being there long enough, without sort of one or two notable exceptions, such as Dreamer, for example, the Dudleys for their run there, not that many members of the roster were actually there for an extended period of time. They were maybe there for only one or two years, disappeared, and maybe came back for a little while.
Lifespan was only 8 years, which is funny when you actually look at it compared to today, where it feels like nothing's happened for 10 years, it's quite telling.
I think you could say the same for the wrestling industry in general. How much in that 3 year period? Right, no, in a 3 year period, 96 to
2001.
That's it's the world changed three times over in that space of 5 years. So I think that's the state of the business.
Like dog years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Moving on, Nowhere Man from TPWW forums. I think ECW's biggest contribution to wrestling was giving fans who are outgrowing the product something they could still be attached to. WWF was pretty much always a cartoon, and the more legitimate NWA had morphed into WCW, and at the time was a flimsy imitation of what WWF was doing, so there wasn't much to offer for people who weren't into the wacky gimmicks and whatnot. ECW's appeal was that it wasn't just the angry kid in the room, but the smartest one as well, since it pushed a more mature product and also took jabs at the worn-out conventions of the big two, as well as really pioneered stuff like the worked shoot. Which didn't really lead to good results when it would be copied by the big two, but as to whether the product lived up to the appeal, well, yes and no. A lot of the homegrown ECW guys like Sandman, Sabu, and New Jack, to be perfectly honest, sucked. I don't even mean from a work rate perspective, but just being able to do your spots without falling over or accidentally nearly killing someone.
This man knows of what he speaks.
However, it did a world of good for guys who were either trying to catch a break in the US or guys who had been cast off and were trying to reinvent themselves to become relevant. And when they eventually made it up to the big two, it had a tremendous impact on the larger wrestling world. So it basically just summed up everything we just said in rather succinct fashion.
I think also that point there is when he was talking about Sandman and Sabu and that other twat. Obviously, anyone that ECW was a great platform for certain people, because if they were good, they weren't in that company for that long. They got hired, you know, as we stated, with all the Benoits and the Malenkos and the Rey Mysterios and even like the Ravens and so on. Most people who did leave that company who were good, you know, left for higher companies.
I think Blaustein in the Beyond the Mat documentary sums up ECW quite nicely with regards to the talent side of it. It's the Ellis Island of wrestling. It's where old talent goes to be reborn and new talent goes to be discovered.
Yeah.
In terms of that, the last contribution there, I think you mentioned about being the product of that was, you know, you weren't ashamed to be a fan of it as you grew up. Absolutely, it was at that moment in time, it was wrestling for adults, and that was it. Did shake up the business because it brought that. Even at its most rudimentary level, even at its most basic level, it brought to the attention of the big boys that's the direction it needs to go. Plagiarised on that, I'm kind of. It's too easy to say. Oh, yeah, everything was
wrong. Influenced.
Yeah, it influenced. Yeah, I think it brought to the attention of the big boys. So that's the way to appeal to the disillusioned masses, maybe of a certain age group. And that bore out anyway.
I think when you have WWF and WCW battling each other like they were at that time, and they were just trying to find any extra rung on the ladder that they any edge that they can do to get over the other company, ECW came along and just kind of showed you, here's that extra thing you can do.
Well, it did that in many cases, because it's like, here's some extra stars and here's how to push them, here's how to make them look good, here's a direction that you can go that will seem exciting. It's actually funny because, Carl, you mentioned before about problems that existed in ECW coming to roost at the end. And one thing I want to touch on here is what he said about you know, the ECW product, especially at first, gave, you know, fans who were disillusioned something they could still be attached to. Do you think that wrestling for adults mentality, when the WWF and WCW kind of took that on, it tied in perfectly with when ECW's revolution pretty much ended? It's just that weird point in time. It's probably that 1997 time where after that, everything really feels like it really bleeds in together for quite a while.
It's almost as if when you get to 97 and the... I hate using the term raid, but it's the first word that springs to mind when you have the sort of the raid of the roster, so to speak. It's as if, particularly in the case of WWF, they, and I don't want to sound like a company shill for them, but they took the good elements of ECW and were able to incorporate them into their framework.
Lesnar Turtle on Wrestling Forum. To me, the best thing about it was its influence. It pioneered things at the major orgs. You know what? It just seems like I should be reading this. It's like we're ahead of the curve here. It's like we've all read this before. Lesnar Turtle. To me, the best thing about it was its influence. It pioneered things at the major orgs and ripped off and did better. The product itself was okay. Shocking production values until late in its life, at which point they were merely subpar. Some great matches and characters with solid talent like Van Damme, Storm, Lynn, Sabu, Taz and Raven, but also a lot of amateurish backyard type non-talent. The only time it was anything other than a distant third to me was when WCW was going to total shit in 2000. Even then, 2000 ECW is pretty rough to look at.
Oh, it was, but better by a lot of stuff standards today.
It wasn't necessarily brilliant to watch, but in terms of business metrics we refer to, you know, if we look at sort of the last 6 months of WCW, in terms of paying audiences, probably not that much difference between WCW and ECW. I know WCW ran larger arenas and had more fans in attendance. When you look at who actually paid to show up, it's a different story. And the pay-per-view buy rate numbers bear that out as well.
Here's a key thing. You mentioned before, off-air, that you wanted to kind of grill Tommy Dreamer for his comments on the ECW DVD about the whole...
Yeah, it's not... I don't want to get too far down the sort of the negative path, if you like, when it comes to ECW, but...
It's all right, it's only about Tommy Dreamer. Go for it.
But when it comes to Dreamers, Dreamer makes the remark about, you know, we were probably the only company in wrestling history to go out of business that was still drawing a lot of fans. Well, the term a lot can be quite subjective. You know, he says they're drawing a lot. If we go through some... The peak of their attendance was 6,000 for the pay-per-view at Anarchy Rules in Chicago. But after that, when you look at the numbers, they had Heat Wave that year at the Harrah Arena, in the same place they had the event in 98. That was down around about 1,000. It was only half filled. You know, creative lighting made it look like it was more of a packed house than it was. Their last two pay-per-views, Yeah, there's a lot of fans there, but it's the Hammerstein Ballroom. It can only hold about 2,500 at maximum capacity. So whilst there was still some rabid fans there, they were still selling out where they were, they couldn't keep up with operating costs. It's not like they were working MSG or some big dome. Yeah, the fan base was passionate, but it was still too small.
Yeah. For what they were looking to be, it was too small. Maluko from TPW Forums, the hardcore part I could actually have taken or left. What I actually liked about it were the interesting characters and stories, stuff I wanted to tune in again and see next week. Heyman had a knack for being able to make anybody interesting, and it made for watchable TV. I only really started to see it deteriorate when they were losing stars too regularly at the end. They had great champions before that, though, and very watchable, intriguing feuds. Just around the table very, 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 very quickly, favourite feud in ECW history. Sorry to drop that on you all of a sudden.
Go. That's quite. Kieran, would you like to go first on this?
G's got it. So.
G's got his. Oh, that has thrown me.
I got it. Yes, because I was going to save this for my outro, I guess, whatever you call it. For me, my favourite feud, and it only kind of really ran, I guess, for two matches, was Taz Bam Bam Bigelow. Because with that Living Dangerously, if I remember correctly, it was in Bam Bam's hometown. And Taz was the television champion, and they were going up one-on-one against each other, and they just made this great point of Bam Bam was the underdog in this match, and this is what this hones into why I was a Taz fan, was how good Paul Heyman put Taz over, to the point where everyone believed, even in Bam Bam's hometown, that he was going to lose to a midget. And that was this great thing, and you have that great, great moment where obviously Taz is—he's got the Taz mission on Bam Bam Bigelow, and he's like, looks like he's tapping his hand, and he falls backwards and falls through the ring, and the crowd just go absolutely crazy. This is before we had any, you know, Brock Lesnar, Big Show ring combustion or whatever,
or Big Show chokeslam and Tigre on Raw. Yeah, in the exact same spot.
Exactly. This was like for me anyway, as far as I remember, the first time we saw anything like this happen. And, you know, Bam Bam gets out and he drags, like, the almost dead-looking Taz out of the ring and pins him and shockingly actually wins. And, again, stressing the shocking part. No one thought it was going to happen. And then, actually, for me, managing to top that at Heatwave, where they do a kind of almost similar spot where he does the tornado DDT on Bam Bam through the rampway. And you think, okay, it's going to be a repeat of what happened before. You know, Bam Bam gets out absolutely fine. And then just Taz just pops up. Absolutely fine dandy, does the old slit across the throat motion, jumps, and then just jumps on him and chokes him out, and it was just fantastic. I just remember, like, at that time when I was watching that, I was thinking, in comparison to what I was seeing with Taz in WWF, it was such a contrast.
It was such a bin man.
Yeah, it was such a contrast where I thought, God, that's what you do with Taz. That's how great that feud was. Like, and Bam Bam, fair play to him, he did a lot of great work with Taz in those kind of two matches specifically. He was really a great foil for Taz. And I remember just, like, watching it at the time, just being amazed, where I just thought, wow, actually Taz is coming across as pretty legit badass here. At least how the perception was.
I can't think of a feud per se that sticks out as like a particularly... I don't think I was invested in the product like that to, like, follow... I mean, I loved the Van Damme Jerry Lynn series of matches were great fun. I want to say Raven Dreamer, but I don't want to say exactly. Yeah. Nothing at all to do with Tommy Dreamer. Just the character development of Raven was so interesting and different. And as I kind of alluded to before, it's like one of the big disappointments of Bray Wyatt obviously being a mid-carder for life, and apparently anyway. It was like we just the hint that we might get something interesting and Raven-esque from him. It just so different. The terms of the least favourite, well, just because as we mentioned, it was the ECW versus Network deal.
I didn't like that.
I didn't like that.
Nah, that was not good.
Sorry, just quickly, just before Carl, if you wanted to put Raven over but not Tommy Dreamer, what about Raven versus Sandman?
It's not all encompassing.
No, it was separate. I was thinking the same. Raven Sandman. The only reason why I do love the angle where Raven's looking for a new whore and Stevie's looking for a new whore for him is pretty funny. And then it turns out it's the Sandman's wife that's the chosen whore. And then the whole thing. The whole thing with Tyler.
Sandman's not even your real dad.
the thing I like it. I don't like the whole, you know, Sandman crying towards the entrance way. It's like it's one of those things that they try and play off as like this really great emotional dramatic moment on the ECW DVD that I just don't like at all. Oh, yeah. But
those fans didn't care.
Yeah. Then they were chatting for Gordy. Terry Gordy, who'd like made his return on the same show. They were chatting for Gordy, and they didn't care. Anyway, the one thing I will say, I do love Raven's promos afterwards, because Raven's promos about controlling the children or just Sandman's, and, you know, some of Raven's best promos came from this, but the feud itself kind of got dragged down because Raven went to rehab, came back, did the crucifixion angle, and then Raven had to apologize.
Oh, that was bogus.
Yeah,
it's
very
stop-start. We're hardcore, no, you're not.
Well, it was really the fans didn't. I don't know. I wasn't there, so I shouldn't really say it. Kurt Angle was the one who complained. Yeah. Therefore, there was pressure on Raven to do it because he was Jewish.
You go down and do an apology. No, you don't do an apology. Come on, you don't do an apology.
Braze until the wrestling end. Anyway, my own personal pick, because I can't really say Raven Sam Maggie didn't really end very well. I'm going to go with Ray and Psychosis, because there's a series of matches. I absolutely love those.
Of course.
Not just the debut in the ECW Arena, but there was a fantastic 2 out of 3 falls match. Actually, I think they put on the Rise and Fall of ECW DVD, if I'm not mistaken, which is a really great match. There's a couple ones that weren't as good, but as a general series of quality overall, I think that was really good. In that environment, in the small building, those matches just seem absolutely nuts. Yeah. Because put that in, and it looks, you know, like it looks like it's in place. You know, in its correct place in the big leagues on Nitro and stuff like that. When you see it in ECW, it's like, this just seems so, I don't say too good for the environment that it's in, but it was so polished.
How great was Mysterio?
He was great.
I was just thinking that.
He was so fucking amazing. You know, by current standards.
I'm glad that Ray's getting some love for this feud, at least, because the anti-Ray sentiment that you usually hear these days, because, oh, well, he's injured and he can't do as much as he used to, kind of thing. It's when people say Mysterio, they get... Anyway, veering off, Carl, you've got to give your suggestion.
I think that you've alluded there to some great series of matches with Van Damme and Jerry Lynn and Ray and Psychosis. Anyone who knows me knows that this won't come as a shock in the slightest.
I think I know where this is going.
But in terms of storylines, I'm going for the anti-hardcore mid-phone.
Of course you are.
I'm a Homer to the bitter end. But Homer, E-R. let's just make that clear, Patterson. But no, in terms of... Because I think with those promos, if you don't get the anti-hardcore Foley promos and the Kane Dewey promos, if the world doesn't see those, if you like, you then don't get the Mankind promos in 96, and you don't get the Taker feud with being what it is. So I know that's sort of snowballing down the track a bit, but those promos, watching those back and not knowing about them after but never seeing them, when I actually got the chance to see them, I wouldn't say blew my mind, but you know, I was gripped by them. They were absolutely fantastic. And for someone to be able to be a genuine heel in ECW, which is something that we alluded to off air, Liam, in ECW, there was always a sort of it was very much a shades of grey, really, wasn't it? Maybe that was because of the fans and the way that they treated people. There weren't many genuine heels in ECW. So I think Foley being able to tap into the anti-hardcore and to get those fans to genuinely despise him,
I think
makes that a great feud.
In his own book,
in
his own book, he does mention that the fans were, you know, they were such great promos. Obviously, the fans still liked him in many ways until he signed with the WWF, and then they really just hated his guts.
I'm gonna say, in keeping with that, it was something I meant to mention when we talk about Douglas. Was he was being the top line lead heel in that company? It's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and that's a credit to Douglas too, as much as you hate
absolutely.
Him. Yeah,
like, absolutely. I was going to say I think there is, although criticism is, you know, it's hard to argue in many cases of Douglas. There's a sense of the Jarrett in TNA and Triple H in
forced,
but at the same, it's a shades of grey between forced and just unlikable heel, and I think it does blend over absolutely. But I think maybe a little bit more credit is due there, because it's a tough position for him.
Tommy Dreamer was a wonderful human being with so much talent and vigour.
I know we've all just gone around like our own options, but I'm just going to like throw another one out here because I just want what general opinions are. What did you think of the much hyped Taz Sabu feud?
I thought the hype and the presentation of the first match was exceptional. Yeah. I think that the again, watching those, especially not 96, because that's where the groundwork was really being laid thick, I thought that was so well done. Like the constant promos about this guy won't faze me, this guy won't faze me. He's doing the step ups on the bench, looking at a Sabu t-shirt saying I'm busting my ass for a company that won't give me the one match I want and stuff like that. And Sabu never replying, doing all these things where, you know, Rob Van Dam, who's a heel at the time, is working on, you know, he's targeting Sabu's neck and he's getting the tips from Alfonso, who's affiliated with Taz, because Taz knows about the neck injury from their time as a team. It's like very layered. I really like that stuff where they were building Taz on one hand here with the stuff with, you know, Paul Valens and his shoot fights in the ring, and then, you know, so, yeah, this certain stuff he was doing. Sabu's just kind of staying the course, doing his own thing, feuding with Van Dam, but it was always there. For over a year, it was always there. But, you know, they were doing the plugs on the WWF show where, you know, Taz hops the rail with a Sabu Fears Taz sign. It's like, oh, it was so well done. And that first match...
Sabu falling off the R.
Sabu falling off the R. But the first match didn't... I don't think any of their matches really...
It failed to live up to the hype.
I'm not really sure if it ever could have, because the hype was so good.
Well, that was it. And that feud, it tapped into the sort of the element of pro wrestling where... It had that sort of a genuine sports vibe to it. You know, it had that prize fight mentality.
Legitimate enthusiasm, you know, for a match.
Back when boxing was at its apex, it had that element to it. And it was sort of that authenticity and believability that wasn't there in storylines in wrestling in 96.
Yeah, big fight deal. It's what wrestling should be. So
that's an honourable mention there in terms of matches, not necessarily, but in terms of promotion of a feud. I thought
we could skip over seeing it. It's so well hyped.
Childs from pro wrestling only. When it comes to ECW, the word that comes to mind is bloated. I didn't watch ECW at the time, so I feel no nostalgia for it. And going through the 90s stuff, I've been struck by how many of the matches and promo segments could have benefited from a tighter focus. There were lots of good kernels, the Foley promos, the FBI, the showcases for wrestlers like Scorpio, Mysterio, and Tajiri, and Heyman certainly succeeded in creating a distinct vibe. But I dislike a lot of what ECW birthed, especially the stunt-focused brawling style. Even the stuff a lot of others like, I'm thinking of the Sabu Funk barbed wire match, I find tedious.
I was just personally, I was never a fan of the barbed wire match.
No,
it was too close to the bone with the violence. It wasn't about, you know, wrestling at the end of the day, as much as we get passionate about it, you know, it's a work. and when you're throwing in the barbed wire, it takes away that sort of that working element, and it has a vicious sort of quality to it that I don't like.
The physical
it doesn't
toll,
sit well with me. Yeah.
The physical toll was really starting to rise around this time. Yeah, again, the stunts were getting more and more. You know, the bumps were coming from a higher place. There were more tables being involved.
Well, just the violence in general is it's a shortcut. And when you got that talent, how do you create a mystique and awe about seeing a match between two guys that really aren't good workers?
Yeah, there was no way for anyone to possibly give a fuck about Ian versus Axel Rotten unless you tape glass to the hands.
Yeah, so you give them, and what happens? Yeah, except what you remember that
that
match.
Was a wince, but from Carl off camera.
But you know that match happened, and which otherwise they
exactly.
Yeah, and it's all part of that creating the notoriety, and it's working with what you got. Yeah. Some of it was a lot of it. Well, even the latest of it was, what was the show he was watching before? Tajiri and Carino.
Carino Hoggle Heaven 2000.
Carino Blades after a brainbuster. And it's why?
Because you had to blade in every pay per view, yeah, I guess. It's violence for the sake of violence.
It's like, yeah, but it's fine. Yeah. But,
Bite all from Wrestling Forum. We didn't get ECW TV in my area, but I read about it in the aftermags for 18 months until Barely Legal came around. Barely Legal was the first ECW show I ever saw. I was hooked before the pre-show hype job was over. I had never seen wrestling like this before. I liked the way their shitty wrestlers went all out to please the crowd. Guys didn't dog it in ECW. Now, for some reason, this is frowned upon by a large segment of the fanbase today, but you saw stuff in ECW that you wouldn't see in the big two. I liked most of what I saw in ECW, but didn't like Shane effing Douglas and his triple threat. Couldn't stand that overpushed jabroni, or just incredible as a later version of the French fries. Anything involving a rotten was dreadful. I still don't get the appeal of the Public Enemy, and the year 2000 was crap.
What was his name again?
Bytor.
It's almost like you've just taken my words and put them down in print.
Oh, that's quite romantic.
Call me.
Copy from Pro Wrestling Only. Love DCW, but it's not the 90s anymore. It's not innovative anymore, and I'm not a teenager anymore. When I was 17, of course I liked a wrestling promotion that was filled with blood, cussing, and women running around in nothing but a thong. I bought into a lot of the characters. I was a huge Raven Mark, and him going to WCW was a big deal to me. Taz and the Dudley Boys were also huge for me. Admittedly, I also thought the world of Rob Van Dam at the time. I was a lot younger, a lot more hormonal, and it felt more real. Also, it can't be overstated how much the crowd was a big part of the appeal. They
all seemed to be having a blast, and I wanted to be part of that atmosphere. It was like a secret underground promotion that not everyone was supposed to know about. When I was staying up until 1 a.m. to watch an ECW TV show on a throwaway sports channel on a Saturday night, it felt a hell of a lot different than a Saturday morning recap show when I was a kid, or the 6:05 Saturday WCW show featuring jobbers and scrubs. All the wrestling itself wasn't great, but it was more about the over-the-top stories, the characters, and there were a lot of good promos in ECW too. I could buy into the show, and was emotionally invested in seeing things play out. ECW was really my first exposure to a hardcore wrestling product. I had seen bloody brawls and whatnot, but I wasn't exposed to Japan or anything in 1998, so seeing New Jack jump from a balcony or the Dudley Boys put Spike Dudley through a flaming table was all new to me. Sabu seemed straight up insane, table spots were new and fresh, so were kendo stick blows. Now, was it all it was cracked up to be? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of revisionist history going on. I feel like a lot of the newer wrestling fans associate ECW with what WWE tells them it was, and others look back on it with rose-colored glasses, probably myself as well. I liked it for what it was at the time. I don't have a huge desire to revisit it, but it filled a wrestling void in my life when I was looking to branch out.
I think that probably sums up ECW.
I think that's a great bit of feedback.
It filled a vacuum more than anything else. I think that's what it did. It filled a vacuum.
At that place in time, from those years, it needed that.
In terms of integrating different talent as well. Yeah. In more ways than one, it filled a vacuum.
Something that he kind of like touches up upon there, which that I want to state, is for me, one of the big selling points for ECW, particularly when I first started watching it, and is something that's actually not in wrestling anymore. When I started watching these VHS tapes of ECW, the one thing that just blared out to me was the unpredictability that came across on the shows, whether some of it was obviously worked or not. Every time I watched one of these shows, I felt like I didn't know what was going to happen. I'll be watching a show and a match that I thought was going to happen, because it says so on the back of the case, because they've got the original card written on the back and not what happened, suddenly the match would change. And it was just that moment where, like, because I was watching this in 2001, where, you know, we were technically still in the Attitude Era. And whilst the Attitude Era was great for its own reasons, this felt something completely different. This felt like another level above Attitude Era, because, like, whilst I was watching that and enjoying that, when I was watching these ECW tapes, I did not know what was going to happen. I didn't know who was going to turn up, who was going to interfere, what was happening. And that unpredictability of these shows was what drew me, and maybe by, you know, the second tape and the third and the fourth and so on, and why I'm such a big fan of wrestling. And it's the key thing for me, which is missing now in any wrestling product, is that they just fail to create unpredictability in the audience.
If I can jump in here on this one, there is always a case to be made for something being unpredictable.
I think we're going to say the same thing.
But I don't take issue with you as such, Chase. Don't get me wrong. I have this issue with the idea of unpredictability instantly means good. To me, there is no point in being unpredictable just for the sake of being unpredictable. Sometimes predictability is absolutely fine. It would have been unpredictable, for example, for Daniel Bryan not to win at WrestleMania once they got to that point. But who wants to see the Batista title win? Just to use that as an example. But with ECW, when you get further down the line, and I think if I can elaborate on my point earlier about sort of chickens coming home to roost, a lot of those cards later on were just unpredictable for the sake of unpredictability. You would have these crazy run-ins because you were papering over the cracks, because the talent wasn't there to cover a pay-per-view in the way that it had been previously. You know, we talk about the excellent series of matches that ECW had, and they were excellent, don't get me wrong. You're not going to sit here and tell me that Jerry Lynn Rob Van Dam wasn't entertaining. You're not going to sit here and tell
me that's not everybody's cup of tea, I suppose. But
by and large, you know, you're not going to tell me that Super Crazy Tajiri wasn't fun to watch, that Rey Mysterio and Psychosis wasn't good to watch. But as you go down the line and the talent pool shrinks and you've got less and less recognisable names, the company had a knack of going back to these same matches. And after a while, no matter how good the match is, the luster is gone a bit, isn't the, you know, the bloom is off the rose to an extent.
It was just the general feel of the show, like when you were watching matches, you didn't know what was going to happen, and it wasn't necessarily always in terms of the storylines. It might have been just how they worked the match and so on. It was just always like, just at 16, 17 years old when I was watching these tapes, I just remember just being on the edge of my seat, because I generally didn't know what the next spot was going to be.
Don't get me wrong, I appreciate what you're saying, but I think Cornette mentioned this once in one of his numerous shoots, and it was the Paul Heyman of, we've got to have a surprise this month. And when you have that,
fans are expecting when the surprise, you have that mentality,
fans are expecting the surprise. We need the surprise. It's not really a surprise, then, is it? Let's be honest. You know, kind of defeats the opposite. I use, I don't know if anyone here is a Game of Thrones fan. Kieran is rolling up his sleeves. I'm somewhat worried now. But to use Game of Thrones as an example, you know, it's the old, there's another shock death, and the Walking Dead is saying, you know, the shock death that you didn't see coming up. Well, when you keep doing these shock deaths, all of a sudden they don't become very shocking anymore, do they? Yeah. It's part of the program as opposed to anything that genuinely means something.
Nintendo logic from Pro Wrestling Only. The problem with ECW isn't that it was bad wrestling, although it certainly was that. It's that it made wrestling as a whole significantly worse. The damage ECW did to American wrestling can hardly be overstated. The supplanting of traditional brawls by stunt wrestling and the rise of annoying fans who do everything they can to put the focus on themselves are arguably the two most appalling trends of the past two decades, and they can both be traced back to ECW. And it's not like it produced tons of greatness to counterbalance this legacy. ECW's rightful place is on the scrap heap of 90s trash culture along the likes of Jerry Springer and Marilyn Manson. This might be Jerry Lawler.
it could be, but the point there is he mentioned the 90s culture.
Exactly.
And that ties into what we've said before, what Kieran's mentioned, what an email has mentioned. We've also alluded to it at different stages of it filling that void. It was the perfect product to reach a certain demographic at that time that had been left behind.
And to the point of, in terms of starting trends of stunt wrestling and stuff like that, if there wasn't an audience for it, it wouldn't have caught on in the first place.
Well,
the reason the fans have become the way they are, I think it's natural evolution, and even though, maybe you can trace it back to ECW, there were heel crowds forever. You know, Philadelphia always booed babyface guys. If you look at WCW papers, where they're chewing them, Baltimore chewing the Midnight Express like crazy at the Great American Mid-South Bash 1990.
Dudes in suits supporting the horsemen.
Exactly. Yeah. Mid-Atlantic.
The
guys are cheering the horsemen. It's not an exclusive thing, and it's just natural evolution. And touching onto what the landscape is right now, where it seems like there's more knowledge amongst the fans than ever. Hence, we are awesome chants, Carl. It's as much, agree, disagree, natural evolution of fandom and the information age. Yeah, more than ECW's fault for starting a trend. Vic Capri from Wrestling Forum. I wasn't able to watch hardcore TV, but once a pay-per-view would be shown, I would do what I could to tune in, and it helps that they brought a lot of former stars in from the big companies, such as Bam Bam Bigelow. Like the Attitude Era, it's something wrestling fans will never experience again. If WWF and WCW were PG movies, ECW was the rated R. They did everything to stick out, the vulgarity, the brutality. It was downhill after Anarchy Rules 1999, and I was done with the company once Justin Credible became ECW champion. He was like the Miz of ECW. This jobber guy, you couldn't take seriously, as a top guy.
Oh, man.
Poor Justin Credible.
He's wearing the jock on the wrong part of his body.
Oh, Mr. Perfect. Oh, man. I don't know if anybody wants to really dwell on the point of Credible ECW champion, but that whole period of time, that's one of the big marks against ECW from a quality perspective. It's that run where after Awesome left, Credible gets the belt, Carino gets the belt, Lynn gets the belt. It's kind of around.
Well, that's it, Awesome leaves, Van Damme breaks his ankle, what's really left? You can't go to Dreamer because he's been there.
Yeah.
Right, in Kieran's case, he's Dreamer, but he's been there forever. So putting the belt on him's not going to mean anything. So you just sort of, at that point, you're just sort of scrambling around for someone to hold the belt. And Heyman, for whatever reason, thought that could be just incredible. I don't think anyone around this table would ever think that was a good idea.
To summarise ECW, we've had a lot of feedback, a lot of very polarising feedback. No one's going to deny the flaws with ECW. I don't think anybody would deny the positives as well, because there were very many of them. Going around the table now, in terms of final thoughts, closing summary on what you think of after everything we've discussed today, ECW's place in people's minds. Do you think that it's still? I mean, again, we've had a lot of from an internet audience, a lot of kind of critical feedback here on ECW. So, do you think that there's actually a bit more of a realistic perception of ECW than one might immediately think?
I would suggest that there is, because people, it's the old case of living in the moment and being able to look back and have a wider understanding of what occurred. And I think looking back in retrospect, people can see the good for what it was, they can see the bullshit for what it was. And it's a situation where you've heard the positive feedback, the negative feedback from around the table and from around the emailers. And it's like most things in sport, in wrestling, in life, whatever it may be, whatever the topic is. You have the sort of the people who think the world of it, the people who think it was the greatest act of treason on the business. And the truth is probably in the middle. And I think it's only in hindsight that people can have the more sort of rational thoughts about it and look back on it. And like I say, you see the good for what it was, whether that's the influx of talent that wouldn't have had an opportunity otherwise, excellent promos.
Some very good matches.
Very good matches. And some excellent storylines. And then you can contrast that with the poor undercard matches, some of the wrestlers that were smoke and mirrors, like Sandman, like New Jack, maybe to a lesser extent Sabu. And you're able to just sort of marry it all up and see it in sort of its full context. And so I know it's sort of a roundabout way to getting to your point, but I do think some of the, maybe the luster has gone off ECW in hindsight.
Okay.
But I think it's a fairer reflection of what ECW was for the business.
And in that sense, do you feel it was all it was cracked up to be?
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was. I think it gave ideas to the top two promotions who were able to maybe carry them a bit further and make them more palatable to a mainstream audience. Whilst at the same time, people who saw its limitations, you know, you can't really argue that those limitations that people pointed to at the time weren't there. You know, they were. It did hamstring the company, and it meant that the company was, in Heyman's words, too big to be small, too small to be big.
No, I just think, that last line is the one probably most people repeat about ECW. In terms of influence, massively important, given, as we said, filling, as one of the contributors said, filling that vacuum, that void, dragging wrestling, or at least making it, slapping the big boys in the face, that what it was missing, that it was behind the times, it needed to be more contemporary. That lost generation, it was definitely serving and bringing the attention that they weren't having their needs met, kind of thing. As a conduit for talent. My overriding feeling, it was a massive achievement by Heyman to create what he created with those guys into a coherent, largely coherent company. It was a massive achievement. I think that's my overall, and it was bigger than it ever should have been. I think that's what maybe people don't take out of perspective, is it should never have been as big as it was and lasted as long as it should have. And you look at the influence and long-term effect it's had on the business, and we're still talking about it, and TNA will not die. and no one is ever going to talk about that in the same way. So
that's a fantastic point.
I don't think there is enough positive adjectives in the dictionary to describe Paul Heyman, and in particular what he was able to achieve with ECW in a short time period. And for me, looking back on ECW, it's mostly positives. I concur with a lot of the negatives that were stated, and there were some, like there is in every promotion, whether it's in WWE, WCW, so on and so forth. But for me, my overall memory of it will always be good. Whether it's like the nostalgia I got from watching the rise and fall of ECW, or the, you know, just that warm fuzzy feeling I got when One Night Stand was first on, and I just realised that holy shit, this is gonna be it. This is gonna be fantastic. It's always going to be the positives for me that outweigh the negatives. And, you know, as stated, whether it's like feuds that we've gone over already, like Taz and Bigelow and Rob Van Dam and Jerry Lynn and so on and so forth, or, you know, talents like the Benoits and the Malenkos and the Tijis and so forth, for me it's always going to be the positives. And as I already stated earlier about, you know, the unpredictability nature of the shows, that just made it kind of come alive to me, that just felt like, oh, anything can happen. And the one major point that I think ECW has achieved is it opened the door to people to get into the industry who weren't gigantic muscular guys. Because leading up to when ECW first came about, you know, the business was dominated by the big guys. And if you were small, you had either no chance or you were lower card. And ECW turned around and it had a roster of people who weren't big and they weren't muscular. They were all small in some way, but Paul Heyman found a way to get a lot of these guys over and to get them relevant with a crowd, even if it was just at the ECW level. And so for me, the long-lasting thing that Paul Heyman achieved with ECW is that he opened the door for people like you and me, who aren't the biggest guys you know, in the world, to somehow get into the wrestling industry or whatever level. And that's kind of like bled through into today, where you're seeing like champions like Daniel Bryan and CM Punk, guys who back in the 80s wouldn't have stood a fucking chance of being a world champion, probably wouldn't even have stood a chance of being on the roster. And I think that's what ECW did. ECW blew the doors wide open so that anybody could get into the wrestling industry. And and to emphasize what Kieran said, he was absolutely right that ECW's legacy, while sometimes might be overhyped, at the end of the day, ECW is still fondly remembered, even more so than any other company that's now deceased, and even to the point where we're dedicating a podcast today.
Just to kind of counteract something you said there, the thing about the, you know, not enough great adjectives to talk about Paul Heyman, it's funny because there is criticism of Heyman in the sense that the company, I mean, he's lauded as a creative genius for the method that he used of hide the weaknesses, show the strengths. The fact that the company never really made any money is largely ignored, and in comparison to promoters like a Jerry Jarrett, who went far, far longer and did far, far better, Paul Heyman probably does, and part of it's self-promotional ability, a lot of it as a matter of fact, part of it is where he landed, part of it is the fact that he's got a lot of great attributes, but there's a lot of other companies that don't get the play ECW does, despite the fact that there's as much merit perhaps. It's one of those really baffling things, and I think what it comes down to, ultimately, the reason why Heyman does get this is because more than any other company ever, again, it's that complete right moment in time thing that you can only capture what if everything is just perfectly right. And Heyman called it perfectly right, and I love watching those ECW hardcore TVs even today, because it's such a different style of television that it sucks you right in, and the time goes by so fast when you watch this show, even if it's not the best wrestling, and you can acknowledge it for not being the best wrestling. But it's still just, it's interesting, it's captivating. The promos in all these different locations just being smashed into this one, you know, Joey Styles, who hasn't been mentioned at all in this podcast. I know you could have the comments about overrated, underrated when it comes to Styles and whether he was anybody, you know, people's cup of tea. But I thought he did a really good job in that role, whether it was Heyman's words through his mouth, whatever it was. Styles was very good in that role. And I think he did rub some people the wrong way. The point that I'm trying to get to, people, is that the whole thing about ECW being the perfect thing, time and place, we are dying for that now. We are dying for something to come along to break these rigid in-place structures that exist in the wrestling world, whether it's contemporary music, whether it's different talent. And WWE is obviously bringing people from, you know, guys like Kenta being signed that never would have happened before, to go to your point, Chase, and stuff like this. But at the same time, we are experiencing now the kind of 93-94 period of goddamn, exactly. We're hoping for that, and you know, TNA is not going to be that thing, Ring of Honor is not going to be that thing, and whether it's jaded perceptions or whether it's something just needs to come along, and I think this is it, something needs to just come along and slap everybody in the cock and say, look at this, this is something, and for it to be right on point with what people want, which it was in 95 and 96. And I think that's why ECW gets a free pass sometimes, and in my opinion, rightfully so, for that very reason. On that note, I want to thank everybody for the feedback. I want to thank everybody for listening. You can subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Squared Circle Gazette Radio. The podcast is going to be in our hiatus for a couple of weeks because me, myself, I'm going back to the motherland of the United States. So I would like to say, on behalf of G. John Chase,
I've still got big balls.
For Carl Jones,
keep it real, homies.
For Kieran O'Rourke.
Check out Kieran_SCG for my exclusive Kate Upton WikiLeaks montage collection of pictures, things from iCloud. Sweet.
I'm William O'Rourke, and for the panel, thank you very much. We are out of here.